Welcome again, everybody, to the next Rugby League European Federation podcast. This will be our Christmas Eve edition. This week we're going to go down a different route, the coaching route. And joining us is Martin Crick, who has been over 10 years now leading the coach education development for the Rugby League European Federation. Martin, how are you?
I'm good, Graham. Thanks. Good morning here in New Zealand, where I am currently, and good evening to you.
Thank you very much. Whereabouts in New Zealand are you, Martin?
Christchurch on the South Island.
Right, but you're originally from Leeds Way, Yorkshire.
Originally, actually, I was born in Herefordshire, of
Oh,
all
right.
places.
Okay.
Yeah. Moved to Yorkshire when I was eight, I think it was.
Right. Okay, and of course, a lot of your family are involved in the game. One son was a big pioneer with Nottingham Outlaws, and the other son is highly involved with Leeds Rhinos, isn't he?
Well, he was until recent events. But that's right. He was community development officer for the Leeds Rhinos, and then he was women's development officer and helped coach the Leeds Rhinos women's team.
Okay. Well, listen, the first question I always ask any guest is, on a personal level, what is your first memory of rugby league?
Okay, well, that's quite easy, actually. As I said, I was born in Hereford, which is obviously non-rugby league territory. Moved to Bradford in Yorkshire when I was eight. Knew nothing about the game. Went to secondary school, and it was the year that Bradford Northern, as they were then, reformed after going out of existence. So that would be 1964. And they came around schools giving out free season tickets to try and reignite interest in the club. And being a typical kid, anything for free. So I took one of these season tickets and I went along to watch the first game of the reformed Bradford Northern, and I was hooked, and I've been in love with the game ever since.
So your first is that magnificent amphitheatre bowl at Odsell. That's your first
That's
experience,
my
right?
that is my first experience of rugby league, walking into Odsell and thinking, wow, where do I go with this free season ticket in this vast space? It was an experience. Just walking into the ground was an experience. But then the first game, I mean, it was just like all kids, I watched football and whatever, but I just couldn't believe the sort of physicality and the I was just hooked. It was just a spectacle and a great game, and I was stood really close to the pitch, I remember. And you could hear all the hits and the thought, yeah, it was great.
Good.
Magic. I was hooked and I kept going, still Bradford Bulls supporter. What so I've supported them now for 50 years.
Wow, that's a long time.
It is, yeah. Through its ups and downs.
Oh, well, there has been ups and downs, but there's some great ups, obviously. So listen, obviously you went on to play the game. You went on to coach as a volunteer, then you were employed in the game at the because you were head of coach education at the Rugby Football League, weren't you?
Well, I wasn't head of coach education. I worked in the department. My role, it's a very posh sounding title, elite coach development manager. But yeah, I was tasked with working with the pro clubs and on coach development programs, and developing coaching qualifications at level three and four.
And was it at the RFL that you got your first introduction to the European Federation?
That's right. It was a small part of my job. I was asked. Danny Kazanjian had just taken over as the European Federation manager, and he wanted somebody that would help to promote coach education within the European Federation. So I was tasked as a small part of my job to work with Danny. So that would be, what would that be now? Back 2009, something like that.
Okay, so what did you actually get involved with? What was your first activity, and what did you
Okay, well, the first thing, I mean, Danny was very keen, and Danny always has been very keen on the importance of coach education, and the idea that we got all these new countries starting to play the game, and what they were doing is they were setting up teams, and focusing on the playing side, but they had no sort of national coach development scheme. So often they would rely on expats or people like that, or people who played the game. But in order to develop it from the grassroots, obviously you need coaches. And so he wanted some coaching qualifications. So I developed a level one and a level two sort of coaching award for the European Federation. And I remember the first thing we did, and I think this was 2011, we had a big gathering down in London, 40 plus people from all over Europe. Well, in fact, from more than Europe, because the European Federation, as you know, covers more than Europe. We're responsible for Africa and the Americas as well. So we had 40 people from South Africa, from Jamaica, from Europe, all came to London for 4 or 5 days. And I got a lot of coaches came down. Steve McNamara, who was England coach, of course, now at Catalan Dragons, and people like Paul Broadbent, Dave Rotherham, so a whole lot of good people came down, and we had a really good 4 days of coaching development and coach education. Yeah, that was really the start of it all.
And it's interesting because, of course, if you grew up, say, in Yorkshire, then, and you went on a coach education course, there is some sort of assumed knowledge, like the laws of the game. And the structure of the game. So was it actually a case of understanding what some of these coaches coming in from abroad, how much they have been exposed to the game and sort of in some ways redeveloping the courses to suit their lack of understanding of the awareness or awareness, basic awareness of the sport, but obviously great energy for it?
Yeah, well, there's a huge variety of experience and knowledge across the countries that we deal with. I mean, you have one or two countries where the game has been going now for some time, Serbia, say, for example, Ukraine. So they have built up their knowledge over that time. But working with countries in Africa at the moment, for example, sometimes you're talking to people who've never even seen a game of rugby league. And one of the first things you have to do is literally show them a game and explain to them what the rules are and how to play it. I remember first time I went to Ghana, for example, none of them had seen a game of rugby league before. So I showed them a game in the morning and we watched the game and sort of analysed it a little bit about how do you play it and what are the basic rules. Then we spent a day out on the pitch with them. And then on the afternoon of the second day, we played a game. And literally that's the sort of situation you can often find yourself in. So it does vary dramatically. Countries where you've got expats around involved, it's easier. But certainly in some of the African countries, it literally has been starting from zero base. Yeah.
And your professional background is education. It must be really fascinating and incredibly satisfying to take somebody from ground zero and actually then see them go on and play their first games and such like.
Yeah. And I mean, there's a whole range of stories we could tell about people that... People fall in love with the game, just like I did as a schoolboy. You know, I mean, the enthusiasm in some of these African countries, and you'll remember from last year at the MEA Championships in Nigeria, the enthusiasm and the way in which they throw themselves into the game is just really inspirational. I mean, people in the UK, I mean, I've been involved in with teams in so-called development areas in the UK, and you'll be equally familiar in Scotland. You know, people say, oh, what a struggle it is to get a team going in a new area where they don't play the game. But at least they've been exposed to it on television. They know the name. They know what the game's about. But that's nothing like trying to start a game in a completely new country where it's alien and where most of them haven't even seen it on TV because it's not on TV over there. So yeah, so these people who are working in Ghana and Nigeria or in Czech Republic or not, they're doing a fantastic job and they are really in love with the game and that's what keeps you going really, their motivation, yeah.
Sure. Okay, so just going back to, you know, obviously the first gathering was an incredibly eclectic mix of people, you know, candidates from around the globe, and then obviously some of the names you mentioned there, like Steve McNamara, fantastic to have them, and so on. So what happened after that? How did it keep developing your relationship with the European Federation?
Well, that was 2011, and beginning the end of 2012, I, along with a number of others, got made redundant at the RFL. In one of those waves of redundancies which have happened from time to time. And Danny said, Danny Kazanji, what are we going to do now in Europe? We haven't got anybody, you know, to do the coach education role. So I said, Well, look, as long as you can cover my expenses, I'll keep working for you until I get another job. And here we are, seven or eight years down the line. I'm still working for Danny now, obviously, but still working for the European Federation on that basis. Yeah.
there's a short phrase that you said that went a long way in the end, Mark.
Yeah, it did indeed. Yeah. So, what was really good was that in 2016, was it, or 2015? Maybe I can't remember. Danny got this Erasmus grant from the European Union, expressly for developing coach education in coach and match official education. Across our member states in Europe. And that, for the first and only time, really gave us some real funding to get out and work. So from 2015 through to the end of 2018, I was quite peripatetic. We put countries into clusters, the aim being that we'd have lead countries who could then cascade the knowledge down to countries within their cluster. And I would go out and run courses and coach education programs with those lead nations. And so that was really the big kickstarter, that Erasmus grant. It meant we could do a lot more than we had done previously. Yeah.
And part of it was also then trying to leave education or educators in the countries.
That's right.
Because there's only one of you and you can't be everywhere. So you're trying to leave, say, listen, you now got to a level where you can pass on, not only can you deliver well to players, but you can actually pass on knowledge to other coaches.
Yeah, that's probably been one of the prime jobs and one of the important ones. And I think I couldn't give you the exact number. I think we've got 13 or 14 coach educators now in various countries.
Yep.
Around Europe. And their job is obviously then to put on coaching courses in their own country. And varying degrees of success. You know, it's... people can't really don't understand how difficult it is in some countries to get any sort of support locally or governmentally for a sport that is practically unknown. So these coach educators have a tough job, and they're all volunteers, so they've all got full-time jobs. But nonetheless, that was the aim, was to get some coach education capacity in each of the countries, and that's still an ongoing task. Yeah.
Well, let's hone in on some of your actual trips then, because I know you've got an absolute host of them. So one I remember a little bit about, you went to Greece at the height of some of the problems that Greece have now thankfully come through in terms of sort of, you know, status of who was in charge of it. So just talk us through there, because it sounds like adaptability is a key theme to when you land in a country with best laid plans, but you're ready to just take on whatever challenges appear.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I'll tell you a little bit about the Greece one in a moment, but I mean, we could take loads of examples. I mean, landing in Russia, for example, and find that nobody speaks English. You're supposed to run a course and there's nobody in the room that speaks English. That's an interesting one. Another one, you land and you find out that what you were promised was going to happen just isn't there. The infrastructure's not there. I went to South Africa and we were supposed to be running, I think it was 4 2-day courses. And then when you got there, you know, they were set up for 2 hours in the evening, and it was like, oh, right, what do we do now then? But Greece, yeah, Greece was an interesting one. I mean, without dwelling too much on personalities, but what can happen, and this is not unique to rugby league, of course, is that when you are a very small organization, some people can who call themselves chair or president or whatever the local nomenclature is, can sort of, I think, get carried away sometimes. And anyway, so we had a situation in Greece where a lot of the clubs were fed up with the way the game was being run there. So I went to run a coaching course, and I turned up at the stadium, and there's, I think, 10 people inside and about double that number outside. not being allowed in. And I said, what's going on here then? And they said, oh, well, we applied to join the course, but they won't let us because we're rebels. We want to change the way the game's run in Greece. So I had a sort of civil war on my hands with you know, a group of people inside the stadium saying they're not coming in and a group of people outside the stadium saying we want to take part. Yeah. So my diplomatic skills came to the fore, I think, is the best way I can put that. So I negotiated a compromise.
And I presume your education's thing to kick in is that, wait a minute, there's 30 people here who want to learn about the game. You know,
yeah, exactly. Exactly. And that's what I said. Look, forget the politics just for these 2 days. You know, we're all interested in rugby league. Anyway, as I say, we got some of those outside inside with the promise that I'd run another one for those who couldn't take part on that weekend. Yeah. And of course, as you know, that situation in Greece has only fairly recently been resolved. And I have to say that the so-called rebels have turned out to be real stalwarts of the game in Greece, and the game's developing really well there now. Yeah,
and it must give you a great source of pride that they're going to be at the World Cup.
Yes, absolutely. Again, so they are going to be at the World Cup, and we know, and you'll see this debate played out in the pages of the rugby league press and what have you, where people say, yeah, but it's not a Greek team. It's a heritage team. They're all players from Australia, et cetera, et cetera. And that can be a bad thing. In the case of Greece, I think it works well because the heritage players there have put a lot back into the game in Greece. They've gone out there, they've run coaching camps. They've got themselves involved in the local game. They're not just Australians who turn up once every 4 years for a World Cup. And the game has sort of grown there with that sort of alliance. In some other countries, it hasn't worked as well, and it does become just heritage teams with nothing put back into the domestic game. But Greece, I think, is a shining example of how things can develop when it works well. Yeah.
And just out of interest, what do you do when you go to Russia and none of the candidates speak English? What happened?
Well, you can put a rugby ball in people's hands, and you know, you can show rather than tell, and it works well. We got somebody to translate in the end. I mean, that was the first occasion I went to Russia. The second time they did have a translator, so that was a lot easier. Even though it does slow it down having to have everything translated as you go along, but that's, you know, that's the issue. That Russia and Eastern Europe, Ukraine, they're probably the countries where that language difficulty is most pronounced. Most of the countries we get by, there's usually some people with enough English to get you through. Yeah.
What other memorable trips come to mind?
Memorable trips. Well, they're all memorable in so many ways. I mean, I cannot emphasize enough the enthusiasm of the people working in these countries. As I say, with no, you know, they're all volunteers. There's no paid workers. They're trying to promote a game to people who've never heard of it. So they're all memorable experiences. Getting a group of people turning up for 2 days or 3 days on a rugby pitch and coaching rugby league is just a massive inspiration. Memorable occasions. Czech Republic's always good. I mean, there's a classic example there, if you like, of a guy who found the game and fell in love with it, David Lahr. I remember he came to that gathering in London as a, what would he have been then, 18, I think, 19. Big lad, obviously loved playing the game. You know, you could hear him for the whole 3 days. He then came back over to England and played for a season at Eastmoor in Wakefield, just so he could get to play rugby league. Lived in a bit of a flat above a post office there, and they got him a bit of work serving behind the bar and things like this. And he still talks about those experiences. And then he's gone back, you know, he's coached at a club. He's coached the national team. He's now working hard, setting up kids teams. And that's the sort of guy you've got. So Jamaica, I was talking about, where, I mean, they've got a really good setup there now. They've got playing it in universities and schools. And I remember going there, though, and going around schools and seeing these kids trying to play rugby league on a patch of ground with no grass, rock strewn, no boots, bare feet, you know, and loving it. And it's experiences like that that make you think that when people back home moan about, oh, we can't do this and we haven't got that, the motto in all these places is can do, you know, we get on, we do it. And it's great. Yeah, it's great. So that was a standout experience for sure.
What you mentioned earlier, some of your African trips. So just talk us through Ghana, you know, because that's obviously not somewhere, you know, 10 years ago that was necessarily in the rugby league radar, but, you know, there's been quite a lot of work done there over the last 5, 6, 7 years.
Yeah, I love Ghana in all sorts of ways. I mean, that started because there was a, and I think it was Danny again, there was a collaboration with the British Council to run some a project out there which included rugby league. I'm not quite sure how we got rugby league in, but we did. And so that's the case. The first time I went, that is the case where I had a group of people in a room, none of whom knew anything about the game whatsoever. And so I literally started with, right, let's watch this first half of this match then, you know, and you tell me what's happening. You tell me at the end what you've seen and what's happening and how you play this game. So that first visit was literally that. And then they got a sort of basic competition up and running. And the second time I went back, I think it was the second time, I actually went back to coach a team to represent Ghana against the student pioneers, the English students that regularly go out to developing countries to help them. So the student pioneers came out. We played three games, I remember, two test matches, both of which were televised. So I was out there for 3 weeks that time coaching this disparate range of Ghanaian players to try and to get them into a team that could compete with the student pioneers. And one of the things I think that you have to try and get people to be a little bit realistic, because there's always these expectations. You know, we're a national team, we're representing Ghana, we're a national team, and these are only students, a set of students coming out, we'll win this. And you have to point out to them, guys, all these students will have been playing the game, a lot of them anyway, since they were 6 or 7 years old. You know, they've got 10, 11, 12 years of rugby league experience in them. You've only got 6 months. So yeah, let's have some realistic expectations. But even so, that was a fantastic experience, seeing them line up and the national anthem played and the pride that they had in representing their country at this sport of rugby league was just amazing. And they competed. Yeah, they lost both games, I think. Can't remember exactly the score, 32-6, 42-12, something like that. But they competed, you know, and at the end of the game, I said, you should be proud of yourselves, because you've actually done far better than I, honestly, at the back of my head, expected them to do. So that was a memorable, memorable trip. And they've gone on since then. Then they're now doing really well. They're probably up there with at the top of the African nations, I think, in terms of the infrastructure that they're building. Yeah. Yeah,
we had John Risman on a couple of weeks ago, and he reckons he had coached rugby league in about 20 countries in Europe. How many countries in the last 10 years do you think you've done coach education development in, Martin?
Well, it would match that, certainly. If I'd known you were going to ask that question, I'd have made a list. But well, I mean, in Europe, I mean, we can very, you know, Russia, Ukraine, Serbia, Latvia, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Greece, Italy, you know, the list yeah, goes on. Belgium, Netherlands. Then outside that, there's South Africa, Jamaica, Ghana.
Canada. Yeah. I think you had a really good trip to Canada a couple of years ago, didn't you?
Yeah, Canada as well. Yeah. I would have been back in the Americas this year if it wasn't for COVID intervening. Yeah, but I had a good week's coaching in Canada. Yeah, so it would certainly match John's number, I think, if I added them all up. Yeah, it would certainly get to that sort of number. Yeah,
well, it's a heck of an influence, and it must be. As you touched upon there, as much as it's about education, it's also about giving these people enthusiasm. You know, the sport does speak for itself, but just allowing that enthusiasm to come to the fore, you know, and I know that, you know, passing on information is a way for people to get enthusiastic, but just, you know, showing them the game and the possibilities, as you say, you must have, you know, there's an art to that, to make sure that people leave with a really big experience, because you know that it's hard work they're going to do when they're in much a minority sport in their own country.
Yeah, and I'll be honest, I've made some mistakes along the way in terms of bringing my sort of expectations with me, and oh, this is how we work at home. And I mean, if we take Africa and Jamaica to begin with as examples, you know, I had to learn a lot of things very quickly. I mean, a lot of these players have nothing, you know, they have come from very, very poor backgrounds. So, and expecting them to have all the correct equipment or all the correct gear or any of this stuff, you know, running a training session and they turn up half an hour late and you're sort of really sort of annoyed about that, only to realize that they've had to, you know, maybe hitchhike for 2 hours to get there, or walk 5 miles to get there, or this sort of thing. So to give them, hence the absolute pride that a lot of them feel in, I'm actually achieving something. I'm putting a shirt on that says I'm playing for Ghana or Nigeria or Cameroon or whoever it is. I mean, look at that Middle East Africa Championships last year. Cameroon, was it? Traveled for 5 days to get there.
Yeah.
Got held up in their bus twice on the way, arrived on the morning of the first game, and still went out there and put in a fantastic performance. Now, you know, in the UK, we complain if we've got to get on a bus and go 2 hours to an away fixture. You know, these guys had traveled five days, on a bus. And then after the tournament, had to turn around and go back and do it again. Yeah. And there's people, you know, as I said, they come from really poor backgrounds, and just the sheer pride when the national anthems were being played and seeing them. Yeah, it's fantastic. And that is part of the joy of doing what we do. I remember running some training sessions in Ghana, you know, and we'd end up with crowds of kids. Can we play, mister? Can we play? And it's that. Yeah, it's good. Because, yeah, soccer rules, but they're not. None of them, or very few of them, sorry, are going to ever end up playing for Ghana or the African nations at football. But we can give them an opportunity, you know, to put on a national shirt and represent their country in rugby league, and I think that means a lot. But it's been good. Yeah, it's been well worthwhile. It's difficult. I mean, I have to say, we were extremely fortunate with that Erasmus funding. Now that that's finished and we're back on basically our own resources, which is, we get a small grant, I think, from the RFL and something from the IRL. But compared to the Erasmus funding, which enabled us for those 3 years to do a heck of a lot of work, we're now back to basics, really. And what we've found during COVID, I mean, this will give you an example of the enthusiasm of, so Ghana, Nigeria, we've been trying to run Zoom education courses with those countries because they wanted to keep going. And it's worked to an extent, but we do need to try and get a much more, usable online presence that we can, because we can do a lot more. I mean, if I have to go out, one, it's expensive. And two, you can only do that so many times in the course of a year. If we get a proper online education program going, then we can do a lot more at a distance. And I think moving forward, that would be my priority, because this year has shown us that, like you know, every country has been disrupted. Very few countries have been able to play. One or two, Czech Republic have kept playing. Serbia have kept playing. But not many more. But yet they're still really keen to carry on with the education side of things. Yeah. And that in itself is great, you know, that these countries want to carry on in spite of everything. It's that's encouraging. Yeah.
And I know also people won't see this because you do a lot of one-to-one stuff with players online as well, don't you? You'll have regular catch-ups with coaching. Yeah. You know, so there's an awful lot of time and effort you're putting in, not just traveling places and hoping getting large groups of people, but just that one-to-one and you know, it'll be educating, but probably keep them motivated as well.
Yeah, because we have a program that in after you've attended a coaching course, there is then some what we call CPD, I suppose. There's some post-course work to do in order to achieve the qualification. So you know, I'm always getting work sent to me. So I would say probably, a couple of days a week, 1 or 2 days a week, certainly looking at things like that and sending it back and giving feedback or preparing the next Zoom call for Ghana or whatever it is. Yeah, it's keeps you busy. Yeah.
Well, listen, Martin, thank you. Thank you for that journey of the coaching. As you say, it's not just been in Europe. I suspect you're probably in excess of 20 countries. And you know, on behalf of the European Federation, all those who benefited from your education, thank you very much. And I know, having coached alongside you, how passionate you are about rugby league and also coaching. And there's no doubt when you land somewhere, people are going to be educated because that's what you are at heart. But at the same time, they're going to be energized and motivated. So thanks for joining us this week.
Okay, thank you, Graham. And it's been a pleasure. Yeah.
Well, there we go, folks. There's the last Rugby League European Federation podcast for 2020. I think for wherever you are in the world, and I know Martin's maybe in a place that he's coped better with COVID, it's been quite a year. So we hope that you end the year in as good a place you can be amongst your families and your communities. 2021 looks like some parts of the world, it may still be pretty hard going, but we know we'll come through it. And of course, we have that wonderful celebration of Rugby League World Cup women's wheelchair and men come October, November in England. So in the meantime, we look forward to joining you again in 2021.